Over the past few weeks, there have been a couple of different occasions when we've talked about infrastructure, including my breakdown of President Biden's infrastructure proposal. But I wanted to get another perspective on all of this. So joining me now, I have columnist for Insider, Josh Barrow, who you can follow on Twitter, at Josh Barrow. Josh, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join me. And before we get into what President Biden has proposed and the politics of all of this, I wanted to start with whether or not it's the right time to take this project on. Do we risk overheating an already recovering economy?
I'm not really worried about overheating. I mean, first of all, the headline number on this bill is very large. It's over $2 trillion, but the money is spent over 8 years. It isn't a stimulus bill. The idea is not to get as much money into the economy right now as possible. It's not like the Recovery Act from 2009, where the emphasis was on shovel-ready projects where you could get the money out right away. The idea is to take some time, fund the right projects on the right timeline. And so the money is, you know, there's not that much of it may actually get spent in the first year. So I think from a macro perspective, I'm not worried about the amount. But the flip side of that is that the idea is not to affect the macro economy through the spending. The idea is to spend the money on useful things. So whether it's a good idea depends entirely on the details of the individual aspects of it, and whether we're going to get good value for money out of those investments. And there's, you know, the bill has lots of parts. There's lots of different ideas about how to spend the money. I think some of them are better than others, but it's really, you know, I realize it sounds simple, but it's going to end up being a complicated question because there's so many things in the bill. If it's good stuff, then it's a good time to spend money on it.
How do you define infrastructure, and how do you think the American people define it? Because it certainly seems like Democrats are taking a very broad approach to that definition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, infrastructure is physical capital that supports the functioning of society. What I would note, first of all, is that, you know, there's no particular reason why this bill needs to consist entirely of infrastructure. They've decided to market it as an infrastructure bill, but they're also calling it a jobs bill. If something isn't infrastructure in the bill, it still might be a perfectly good thing to spend money on. And the flip side of that is there are some ideas that are infrastructure, but it's not really the infrastructure we should build. I think the importance of this has been maybe overrated a little bit, but partly what's going on here is because of Senate rules around budget reconciliation, the special process where you can move legislation through the Senate with just 50 votes instead of 60, means you don't need Republican votes. You can only do it so many times during a session. And so that it creates the incentive to roll this stuff up into fewer bills with more stuff in them. So you need to combine some unrelated things into the same bill. So there's some stuff in here that, you know, I think is clearly not infrastructure, such as $400 billion in spending to enhance home care.
Yeah.
for Medicaid recipients, which I think is conceivably a worthy goal. It's not really infrastructure spending. It's also a slightly, you know, there's a lot of aspects to that care economy, nursing homes and various things. This is all money focused in one particular area. It's not clear to me why that rather than a broader increase in spending on care in homes or and out of homes. The other stuff I think is there's some research and development spending, and so that's on intangible stuff. It's not really infrastructure, but that can be a great way to invest and support our economic growth in the future. And then most of the physical stuff in here really is infrastructure. There's about $600 billion in change for highways and airports and rail systems and that sort of thing. There's other stuff that I find it really weird that people are saying this part isn't infrastructure. There's money for power systems,
yeah,
for upgrades in water systems, including taking lead service pipes out of systems, which cause people to get, you know, lead into their bodies. And there's money for broadband, and that stuff is, I think, core infrastructure. I've seen some Republicans saying, you know, well, replacing lead pipes isn't infrastructure. It seems to me, of course, the water system is infrastructure. And then finally, there's a bunch of money for housing. And I think that there's some very good ideas in the housing component of this bill. Housing is not something you typically refer to as infrastructure. Infrastructure serves homes. It doesn't include homes. But again, I'm not sure that semantic distinction is important. There are a number of housing needs that the government can productively address, and I think it's fine to use this bill as a vehicle for that.
I'm joined by Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider, who you can follow on Twitter at JBarrow. We're talking about infrastructure and what parts of our country's infrastructure do you think really need to be addressed? If we were making this bill, this package, smaller and more targeted, what parts do you think are essential to keep in it?
The stuff I like best really is actually the non-transportation infrastructure. I think there are significant public health benefits to removing lead pipes. That's something that I think it would be great for the federal government to spend more money on. We've seen from the disaster in Texas the importance of power grid upgrades. Also, as we move to a greener economy, we're going to have more intense demands on the electrical power system as we shift toward electric vehicles. Not only do we need infrastructure to be able to charge those vehicles, we're also going to need to be able to move more electric power over the grid because we're going to be depending on more energy for that. We also may see that in homes over time. You're seeing increasingly energy efficient electrical systems for heating and cooling through heat pumps. And if more people move to that and away from gas and oil heat in their homes, that will also increase demand on the power grid. So I think those upgrades are good. I think one thing we've seen in the last year with the shift to more virtual work, some of which I think will be permanent, I think that further demonstrates the importance of broadband upgrades and more universal broadband access. There's money in this bill for that. And, you know, in conjunction with the electrical grid stuff, there is stuff about electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging, which I think is a good place to invest. Those are all things about looking at what the economy is likely to be 20 years from now in the future instead of what it is right now. On the transportation side, the U.S. has a real history of getting bad value for money on transportation projects, especially, I mean, people see a lot of coverage around, you know, the most expensive subway in the world per mile is the new expansion of the Second Avenue subway in Manhattan. Also, urban highway projects we pay a lot compared to other countries for. And so if we're going to overpay for that stuff, I think we need to have real clarity that it's really adding a lot of value. And I don't think we have that clarity. And that's especially because we don't know what the ongoing transportation needs are going to be in this country. If you have a lot of people who used to go to the office 5 days a week, and some of them are going to start going in only 3 days, and some of them are going to start working from home entirely on an ongoing basis, then some transit systems and some highways that looked like they didn't have enough capacity may actually prove to be sufficient in the long run. If there's a persistent decline in business travel, there's a lot of airports that probably thought they needed a new concourse or some other expansion that may actually not be needed. So this isn't the time that I would be putting a lot of money into new highways and transit systems and rail, because I don't think we really know what our ongoing transportation needs are. I think that that infrastructure may be more sufficient than we thought. And then also, people love to throw around this report card from the Civil Engineer Society that always says that our highways and our bridges get a D minus or whatever. But these are civil engineers. They're in the business of selling civil engineering. So, of course, they're always telling you that you need to hire more civil engineers and do more civil engineering projects. When you do a cross-country comparison, we have lower commute times than most other rich countries. Our roads have improved their shape over the last 30 years. They actually have this index of road roughness, and our roads are smoother than ever right now. And our stuff is broadly in better repair than most of our peer countries. Now, obviously, there are lots of individual bridges that need certain work, and there are highways with potholes, and there are parts of the country where that stuff is in worse shape than others, and that should be addressed. Of course, we already spend a lot of money on addressing that. But I don't buy this narrative about America's crumbling roads and bridges. I think that this is an area where we've actually done fairly well. It's not clear to me that we need a big expansion in spending on it.
No, it's actually the power grid and the pipes and things like that. That's the infrastructure that is really old in certain areas. And like you mentioned, could use a real upgrade. And you mentioned rail a moment ago, and that's something that concerns me. Look, here in Florida, if you could connect Tampa to Orlando and have a decent setup where it takes you maybe a half hour, you don't have to go on I-4, which could take, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours or longer, depending on the disaster that's on the road that particular day. I think it could be game changing because you could have a lot of people living in Tampa or living in Orlando working back and forth. But I also wonder if this is something that we should wait on because you do have new technologies that are emerging like the Hyperloop, and that could be the way to go to connect certain cities rather than rail, which we've seen, California, a great example, just costs a fortune and sometimes just doesn't get done.
Well, I mean, Florida is unusual because you have this ongoing intercity rail project that my understanding is it's largely privately financed.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it already goes from Miami to West Palm, and it's in construction to Orlando. I know they're planning that Tampa expansion. So I don't, you know, I don't know why that works there and not anywhere else. It might be that Virgin Trains is never going to make money on it and they're making a dumb investment, but I'm, you know, perfectly happy to let, you know, private capital go in and give that a try. The other thing is that, you know, I mean, I understand they're developing a station of Walt Disney World. So I assume that the customer profile for that looks different than it does in a lot of other markets, less reliant on business travelers. And so I, you know, I'm sure that Walt Disney World is going to remain a draw indefinitely. And so that's a case that particular project is less impacted by the question of, you know, are we going to have 30 or 40% less business travel persistently as people realize that all of these meetings they were flying for, they can actually do on Zoom. And then my other sense is that the land acquisition and where the rails have to go for that project don't have some of the astronomical costs that you have had associated with the California project. So this stuff is all very location specific. I think that that project in Florida is a lot likelier to work than some others. But again, since that's a private project, we don't really need a big infrastructure bill in order to get that done. I think in terms of, you know, far future technology stuff, I feel like, you know, I mean, we've been hearing for decades about maglev and things like this. And I'm a little skeptical about these novel high-speed ground transportation concepts. We'll see. But I mean, fundamentally, for distances more than about 300 miles, there's a real speed advantage to flying because you can go at 500 miles an hour. And while we have long run climate challenges, we are, you know, I think we have very promising ways to address those in other parts of the economy with the home heating, with electric vehicles. So I continue to believe that air travel is going to be the dominant mode of travel for those long distance trips, especially because, I mean, that what's being built in Florida is reasonably fast, but it's not a France style high speed rail system. And that stuff just has enormous capital and land acquisition costs that you don't have when you fly through the air.
I'm joined by Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider, who you can follow on Twitter at JBarrow. We're talking about infrastructure. Now, the other aspects of an infrastructure package that sometimes don't get discussed as much but are going to be critical, and you alluded to this, being able to get some of the stuff done in a cost-efficient manner. There's a lot of challenges in this country in particular. Can you kind of step through just a few of them as to why sometimes this stuff, it just costs so much more in this country? And have you seen anything in the president's proposal that would alleviate that, that would potentially address that problem?
I don't think that they have anything that's going to make a huge impact on that yet. And I wrote for New York Magazine a couple of years ago a feature piece on why all of it, especially in New York, but really all around the country, these projects are so expensive. And the problem is, it's not one big thing we do wrong. It's 50, you know, small to medium things that we do wrong. And each of them is challenging to fix. And if you fix them, you know, you maybe shave 1% off the project cost. Then you have to do yet another and another and another challenging thing. And so it's every step in the process. We over-design these projects. If, you know, a lot of these subway stations, it's like going into the Bat Cave. You do these enormous underground excavations, 100 feet below ground. Very expensive to do that sort of work. Other countries that build subways more cost-effectively, maybe only 20 or 30 feet below the street, they do relatively simple stations. We do have problems with overstaffing on these projects, like the tunnel boring machine that you use to build a subway line. Takes 25 people to drive it in New York and Paris. They're able to operate that machine with 9 people. And then you also, you do have higher pay for the construction workers on these projects here than even in other rich countries like France. But the bigger issue seems to be the staffing levels rather than the pay levels. And then you have a planning process that's very consultative with sort of endless open meetings and environmental reviews. And both that, you know, that time adds borrowing costs because it's more time before you actually start generating any revenue or economic activity off the project. But it also means that in order to get people to stop suing you, in order to get people to stop, you know, stop fighting through the political process to defeat your project, you often have to make expensive choices and compromises to placate them. That means burying projects that maybe more appropriately would be run above ground. It can be, you know, sort of odd technical things like they're building a brand new terminal, underground central terminal in Manhattan. So it's like a whole additional station, 140 feet below ground. And they didn't want to truck like dirt through Manhattan through the excavation of that process. So they had to run it all through the tunnel to Queens and take it out there. That added a whole bunch of time and cost to the project, but it meant that people in Manhattan who would have been complaining about the noise and the trucks full of dirt weren't complaining about it. You make choices like that over and over and over again, and you end up adding a lot of cost to these projects in ways that doesn't necessarily make them more useful as transportation infrastructure. And it just means we're not getting as much value out of our money.
And then one more question for you real quick. The president has broken down his overall infrastructure proposal into two different parts. The total will likely be somewhere around $4 trillion. The first part came in at around $2.3 trillion. Do you see at least one of those parts getting passed through Congress? And would it more likely be the part that contains infrastructure as most people think of it?
I mean, I think that we will see some amount of this agenda become law. I don't think it's going to be like the initial relief bill that Biden did, where he made his proposal and it sort of looked like an opening bid, but then in fact he got almost everything he was asking for. That you need to hold every Democrat on this, and Joe Manchin and some of the other moderates in the Senate have been showing wariness about certain parts of it. There's also a whole tax increase component to this proposal. It's not really necessary to do it because the interest rates are so low. You really could finance this stuff by borrowing, especially if you're doing useful infrastructure investment that will grow the economy.
Right.
That's kind of the most appropriate kind of government spending to borrow for. So I think that, you know, trying to agree on a corporate tax increase and change to the rules in the corporate tax, I think that's going to be challenging right now. So I think there will be a limited version of this agenda. I don't know how many bills it's going to go into, because some of this stuff really could have a lot of support on both sides of the aisle, and Congress already routinely does highway and transportation bills anyway. So some of the things that are in here you could put in regular appropriations bills or in the next highway bill, and have that done on a bipartisan basis, and then you could have a narrower bill that would be a partisan Democratic bill. But I think a lot of this stuff they'll be working through in one form or another for the next year and a half. So I don't know that we'll hold up one package and say this was the package, but I think some components of this won't get done, and other components of it will probably get done in a variety of legislative vehicles over the coming years.
All right. Columnist for Insider, Josh Barrow. You can find his work at businessinsider.com, and you can find him on Twitter at JBarrow. Josh, really appreciate the time this evening. Thanks so much for joining me.
Of course. Thank you, Ryan.
Coming up next, I'm going to talk to Mark Caputo, political reporter for Politico. He's going to offer his thoughts on the fallout from that 60 Minutes piece on Governor DeSantis. We'll get to it in a moment on PM Tampa Bay.